Well, how about it? Who's going to go out and get pizza tonight? Loaf of bread? Can't wait? All right. Go ahead, then. Emily. Everyone knows the definition of sin according to the Bible. 1 John chapter 3, verse 4. Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. Got a little graphic up there about how leavening gets in to the bread, and it produces various things. The fermentation process mainly. You know, alcohol, sugars.
Carbon dioxide.
The gases, the rising. We've talked before while we're up here about how it actually rots the dough. And I wish I would have recorded a better explanation of all this from Charlie Kimbrough, but and how sin, when it gets in our body, it rots our body, it rots our flesh, and destroys it. Passover and the days of unleavened bread start the yearly holy cycle, or holy day cycle. Passover, of course, represents the sinless lamb that bore the sins of the world and gave his life for all of us. And the leavening represents the sin. And what we're supposed to be doing by eating unleavened bread is putting the leavening or the sin out of our lives. We just went through a exercise, and today is the seventh day of that exercise of putting the leaven out. And unfortunately, just like there are cravings for things that have leavening in, there are cravings for sin. And we're dealing with those same things. And if we're not really diligent, sin is going to sneak into our life. You know, when we went to that toxic waste place called the Golden Arches, or otherwise known as McDonald's, and I thought I was going to get an ice cream cone. Was told we couldn't have an ice cream cone because our ice cream machine didn't work. And then I asked about a sundae. No, those sundaes, that's the same machine. Or they just said they weren't able to offer that. Then they offered McFlurries. What would you like, M&M McFlurry or Oreo? Well, somebody said Oreo. And somebody else said, no, two M&M McFlurries. Why? Because Oreos have leavening, and he tried sneaking it in. One of the first years we were keeping the days of unleavened bread, we used to rent a motel room, conference room in a motel, actually, and have church there, and didn't know any better and loved those little fat burgers, and I was cheap. So every Sabbath, we didn't know and understand about buying and selling on the Sabbath. We'd stop at the McDonald's right where we turned to go to the motel, go down the road. And they were 29 cents.
Wow.
That was the...
Crazy.
Yeah. Well, it was a special because they were about 29 cents when I was a kid. But for a year, they had a 29... This McDonald's, they were... And my oldest daughter would say, can I have a cheeseburger? And I'd say, I ain't paying 10 cents for a piece of cheese. Because they were 39 cents. So you should have brought your own cheese from home. But it was one of the high days. I think it was the first high day, first day of unleavened bread. We stopped at McDonald's. We got our bag of fat burgers. And I took one out of the bag and opened up the wrapper and I bit down and I started chewing and saying, oh, that's good. And somebody said to me, Mary, one of the kids, I don't know, they said, Isn't that leavening? It is. And then we had to throw the suckers away. Yeah. Should have kept them. They probably still look just fine today. Show us that as an example. If you ever saw Supersize Me, they don't rot, they don't age, they don't. And same with the fries. You can dig them out between the seats years later and they still look okay. But anyhow, gratefully, I didn't swallow, but I had a mouthful of leavening on a high day. And that's how sin is. It's everywhere. That's why I believe God chose leavening. You can't see it, but it's everywhere. It's in the air. It's all around you. Now, we all cheat and use Fleischmann's and different kinds of yeast if you even make bread. I think some people think that bread comes only from the grocery store. But I remember, I don't know if, I think it was my great-grandmother, where she would. I mean, you go over to her house and she'd make the German pancakes, and I still would like the recipe for those things. But one of the things she would do, and everybody sees it on the movies, but this is how she never bought yeast from the grocery store. She'd make bread or something. She'd cover it with a towel. She'd put it on the windowsill and open the window in her kitchen. And all on its own, you come back and you look, and the bread is puffed up. It's raised. How? Because the yeast is in the leavening. The yeast spores are in the air. You can't see them. You can't decontaminate it. You can't, no matter how hard you try, they're there. If you've never done that or if you've never seen that, do an experiment. Take some dough and set it out on a nice summer day or spring day and set it out in the windowsill and watch what happens. And that's the same thing that happens with us with sin. And it'll get into our body and it'll start to ferment and it'll rot us and corrupt us. Several years ago, we were at Laguna Beach in Florida. And after we were there a few days, Dr. Andre pulled me to the side. It was his first Feast of Tabernacles. And he asked me why so many people in the church were sick and had money problems. And I says, "What do you mean? Why so many in the church are sick?" I says, "You see sick people all day long. That's what you do." And he said, no, I'm talking about percentage-wise, comparing the people in the church to the world. The percentage of people, the level of people that have serious health issues and monetary, financial issues, it's much higher than people in the world. I told him, so this was the reason why. Because it was a curse. See, we have a blessing or we have a curse. And it's on us which one we have. Deuteronomy 11:26 says, "Behold, I have set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today. And the curse, if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after God, other gods which you have not known." See, we can't, if we lay hold of the covenant and we become part of Israel, there's tremendous benefits that come with that. And also, if we don't do what God says, there's a curse. The heathens can do things and get away with it. You notice, he doesn't just say, nowhere in the Bible are you going to say, "Oh, look at all the heathens, I'm just going to smite them all with disease and sickness and financial problems and split up families and ruin relationships, and they're heathens. They don't know no better. He hasn't called them. He hasn't opened up their eyes. It doesn't mean he doesn't love them, because he's got a plan that includes them. But they're just doing what it is that they do. But what happened every time Israel started doing the things that the heathens do naturally, normally? It's a way of life.
They went into captivity.
He says he's going to punish us seven times over for our sins. Now, unless you like to be miserable and suffer, you need to take this seriously. Deuteronomy 29:14 says, I make this covenant and this oath not with you alone. Moses is talking to the people of Israel, and God told them to say these words. But he says, not with you alone, but with him who stands here with us today before the Lord our God, as well as him who is not here with us today. Who do you think he was referring to? He was talking about us and everybody in the future and everybody between Moses and us today. These things weren't just for a certain people 3,500 years ago. That doesn't apply to everybody that is called by his name today. It includes us. When are we going to start acting like it includes us? Millions of people have just celebrated Passover and renewed their covenant with God. If you claim that that applies to you, and you observe his covenant and his commanded assemblies, you lay claim to the blessings and the cursings if you're able. We cannot get away with it. Now, did he put those cursings in there just to wake us to punish us? Like, you tell the dog, you go outside and go to the bathroom, and if the dog doesn't go outside and go to the bathroom, you just grab a newspaper and you start whipping it and chasing it all over the house, and then when the newspaper finally falls apart, you grab it by the neck and you take its nose and you shove it in there and then you whip it some more. Is that how we think that God is doing? No. The cursings are there because he allows people that he has not called, that he does not open their eyes so that the scales fall off their eyes, to do those things. But for those of us that he's called, he has to wake us up. Why? Because if he doesn't wake us up and we die in our sins, it's over for us. You're not going to come up in a second resurrection. You're not going to hear it straight from Jesus' mouth. You're not going to be brought up in this literal paradise and have your first opportunity, because you've had one, you knew it. And it doesn't make any difference if you stand there and give them the finger and walk off, or you just ignore it and pretend like you've got some special dispensation to do those things. The end result will be the same. And he does not want even one of his children to choose that path. Where does it say that he starts with judgment? He starts at the house of God, and it goes out to the world from there. There's somebody listening. All right. He starts with his children first. You're held to a higher standard. Go ahead. Every year when we observe Passover, do we really gain insight into the nature of God? What is the Song of Moses? And what are people supposed to feel, see, and understand when they sing it and they read it? Exodus 15:1, it says, "And Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation." Yeah, you got the biggest and strongest daddy in the entire world. But if he is not your strength and your song, you're an orphan. And he has become my salvation. Instead of just thinking about, oh, look what he did, it was so glorious for the children of Israel, is he your strength, your song, your salvation? "He is my God, and I will praise him. My Father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war." Yes, he's a God of love. But there is a war going on. And if people don't realize that, they will be destroyed. You can read the verses about this war. Everybody knows about how Satan goes to and fro, seeking, like a roaring lion, seeking who he can devour. If you think that's some mythological fairy tale and it's not real, you're blind, spiritually and physically. Verse 4, "Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea." If he can do that to Pharaoh, the most powerful god, because people worshipped him as a god, what can he do with anything else that comes against you? "His chosen captains are also drowned in the sea." So all the little minions that were following Pharaoh, that were in charge, and were the taskmasters and the slave drivers for Pharaoh, he chucked them in the sea also and drowned them all. "The depths have covered them. They sank to the bottom like a stone." Why don't we believe God can actually do that for us? You know, you look at the stories of Samson, David, Gideon, Elijah, and it goes, the list goes on and on and on. The things they went through, yes, God's people experienced tribulations. It happened then, it happens today. But he sustains us through them and delivers us from them. But yet they still exist. So many in the church are afraid to do the right thing. Not everybody, thankfully. But so many are. They're afraid of possible consequences. They've listened to Satan's little whisperings in their ear to discourage them from standing strong, from standing up against insurmountable odds. And it is a scary thing. From being strong. Because they really can't believe that God is going to intervene. You know what? When you look back at the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they made a decision against insurmountable. They showed them the fire. They could feel it. And they knew that was their destiny. Our God can save us. But even if he doesn't, we're not going to do this evil thing. Now, it doesn't say this, but if it helps you get through it, You know what Pharaoh said? Wait a minute. Didn't we throw three guys in there? It looks like there's four of them in there walking around, and one's the son of man. And he calls them out. Now, you know, I wasn't there because I would have said, well, why don't you come on in and get me? But there are things, and that's not really the right motivation, but there are things. Daniel, he knows that if he prays, it's over for him. There's a possibility. God can intervene, yes, but what if he doesn't? He didn't go. Daniel was the second in command. Do you think that Daniel had a little one-bedroom shack?
No.
He opened the curtains and got down and prayed so that everybody could see. In essence, what he was saying is, kiss my butt. I am going to worship the Most High God and nobody else.
Three times a day.
Morning, noon, and night. So that nobody can miss them. I don't care what your schedule is. When are we actually going to believe what it says in Philippians 4:13? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Yeah, but.
Yeah.
We can't. It doesn't say you can do all things because you have the power. That's not it. They can squish us like a bug. People have misinterpreted things and thought they were more important than they were and taken on governments, and they all get killed. Taken on various things and they get wiped out. Taken on employers or you name it, they've done it and failed. It's not us that are so great, us that are so special, us that have these great abilities. It's our Messiah.
Amen.
It's Him and Him alone. We've got to understand the purpose of God's commandments. Deuteronomy 8:1 says, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart. Most people think that God was looking down and saying, What are they doing? No, He was looking at what was in their hearts. That's what separated people. There are people that actually do it, but their hearts are stone. They're not doing it for the right reason. Whether you would keep His commandments or not, so He humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds of the mouth of God. If we don't understand that, it's not the food we eat that nourishes us. It's not the money we make that defines who we are. It's what is in our heart and what we do with every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. That makes you who you are. Verse 4, your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in His ways and to fear Him. Like I said, sin is like a cancer. that will eat your body from the inside. It will destroy you until you're dead. Just like, even though it's hidden, just like there are cures for cancer, there are cures for sin. Everybody in this room, a friend of mine wrote this years and years ago, everybody is suffering and we have a terminal disease. It's going to kill each of us. The disease is sin. Nobody likes to admit it. Nobody likes others to know what their sins are. We try and hide it. But we all have it. And we all suffer from it. And sin usually starts with a small problem. And it turns into a huge fatal problem that can cost us our lives and our salvation. Just like 3 million Israelites who never entered the promised land. You realize, they went 40 years. And it took 40 years. Yes, I understand about the 40 days and the spies, but it took 40 years until all of them were dead except for two. 3 million people at least came out of Egypt. And two that came out of Egypt entered into the promised land. Why didn't they all get to come in? Sin. Why does God choose the analogy of leavening and sin and how it destroys us? Look at 1 Corinthians 5:6 says, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast not with old leaven or with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. You let just a little bit of sin in? Oh, it's not so bad. It's not really terrible. It's not nearly comparable to sins of other people. This is just so minor. What does a little sin always turn into? If you don't take the antidote, repentance. Repentance is the only true vaccine that's going to save your life. Otherwise, the disease, sin, will kill you. God commands us to put out all the leavening from our homes for 7 days and only eat unleavened bread during that time, which a lot of people faithfully do. More than ever, every day that passes, it is more important that we need to look at all of the leaven in our lives. Not just reading the ingredients on a package, but looking at the leavening that really counts, sin. And throw it out. Who's ultimately responsible for the actions of their family? Huh? I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
The parent?
What parent?
Oh, yeah.
The father. The parents, yes, but the one that's ultimately responsible, that it's on his head, is the father. When you take a look at Daniel, Moses, Abraham, and the list goes on and on, all of these great men of the Bible, what's the one thing that made them, David, the one thing that makes them stand out? They wanted to do what was right. Yeah, they all screwed up, every single one of them. But in their heart, no matter what, they tried to do what's right. If you work for a company, do you want a true leader to lead you, or do you want an overbearing dictator to be your boss?
A true leader.
A true leader. I was never in the service, but I know that great men that were in the service, that their people would follow them into battle and give their lives, did it because of the respect for their leaders. A true leader of a company or a family knows what's happening in the business and in the family. He takes responsibility for the failures and gives praises to everybody around them for the successes and the triumphs. That shows what's in the heart. See, even if he's able, his heart isn't right, he's able to pull off this good-looking family or whatever. And he says, look at me, look at my family, look what I have done. It ain't going to work. It's my family. I'm so blessed to have them. God has given me my wife and given me each of my children. And he's only great because of those around him, and he makes sure that they know. A good leader is a good problem solver. And a family without a leader is like a ship without a rudder. There are people here, I know, but who was with us when we were down 10, 15 years ago? We went on, I think it was called the Sea Screamer. It was one of those cigarette-shaped boats, has two engines in it, 400 or 500 horsepower in each engine. We got out into the bay. The guy opened it up, and you get up on a plane, and the spray is flying all over the place, and we're headed out to sea. And they take you out there wide open, and that's why they call it the Sea Screamer, because those engines are just screaming, and we're flying across that water. And then the guy took the wheel, and he went like this so that we could run parallel to the land, which you could hardly see anymore because it was really small. Who was with us that year when he went and took the wheel like this and nothing happened? And I wasn't driving, Emily. Eva, Jason, nobody else was here. We went on a little more than a 3-hour tour. We were headed straight out for sea. The rudder didn't work. Two powerful inboard engines. And the thing won't steer. It won't go anywhere without a rudder. What good does it do you? Several hours later, we limped back into the dock, and he did it by going slow, and he'd have one engine, and he'd rev it up, and the other engine, he'd just leave it at idle, and then if that still didn't turn us enough, or the breeze or the waves were too much, then he'd take that second engine that was just idling, and he'd put it in reverse, so one's pushing, one's pulling, and then the boat would turn like this. And when we finally got back to dock, they said, we're so sorry. What we're willing to do is give everybody a free pass to come back tomorrow. I wanted my money back. That sucked. I felt like, you know, a 3-hour tour and, you know. We didn't end up on a desert island, but I didn't know where we were going to end up. You know who came back the next day? Nobody. We all had passes. I want nobody stepping on that ship. Is it any wonder why somebody that's supposed to be the leader of his family, the crew abandons ship if he's a worthless and unprofitable leader that's leaving them like there is no rudder and his heart is not right with God? I know it goes on because the divorce rate is no better in the church than the world. And if you look at generation after generation after generation of families, see, I've seen it all. Oh, let the children have a free spirit, because if we come down on them, they're not going to want to come to church when they grow up. That is people that are in the church that are telling others that they're going to let their children be a free spirit because they don't want them to go through the same things they went through when they were a child, and they're afraid their children are going to turn against church. The very first family that told me that in the church almost 30 years ago, when their children grew up and were old enough to make their own decisions because they let them be free spirits, I asked them, why won't they come to church because they know the truth? And they said, any church where my parents would be, and I'm not making this up, the oldest son said, any church that would allow my parents to come there, I won't have anything to do with. And they're all heathens. Not a single one of them keeps the Sabbath. Not a single one of them keeps the holy days. And they're all off doing their own thing. They are free spirits, all right. They abandoned it. But wait a minute, these were people that were there in church keeping the Sabbath telling me that they didn't want their children to have the same experience they had. How about instead of just letting them decide for themselves, they make sure that they don't make the mistakes that their parents made. That they don't make it a torture if they felt like it was torture. That they know what not to do, so don't do that. When you see, and there are people, and those will think of various people when I say this, but there are people that when they show up at a feast site or something like that, you think, oh boy, because it's just utter chaos around them. Whose fault is it? The kids? No. The father. One that I actually had to take his wife aside and tell her some things she could do because her husband was abusive. And then I told him, I said, you touch her again, she now knows how to kill you with her bare hands. And if you do it here, she won't have to. Because I'll be the first one on top of you. There are parents. One man brought his family and his children more than 25 years ago. And the church that he belonged to, he said, well, that's the way they did it there. I never went to that church. God spared me from it. But I can't believe that they actually told him to do this. But anyhow, people came and got me. Services were over, and I was inside talking to others, and some guys came and got me. He says, you need to get outside. You need to get outside now. He had his son by one arm, and his feet were about that far off the ground, and with his other hand, he was whacking his son, and his feet would fly up beside him, and his butt would come back down and he'd whack him again. And I got up in his face and I said, you touch that kid once more and I'm going to do that to you. I'm not proposing that we do evil because we think that evil is good. A true leader is an example. It's like a light on a hill, a shining light that draws others to him, that his heart is right, that serves God first and ego last. Would you actually get on a plane if you found, if when you were boarding the plane, you saw the pilot and the co-pilot arguing about which route they were going to take to get to the destination. Not agreeing which way was the correct, and one saying, that's not how you get there, this is how you get, and they're arguing back and forth. Would you get on that plane and sit down? How do your kids feel if that's what's going on in their home? They don't get to get up there and fly the plane. They don't get to make the decisions. What does God expect? Ephesians 5:22, it says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husband in everything. Now, most people just stop reading here. There's more, and I'm going to read it. But what is the defining factor for a wife and her husband? When the submission ends, at what point? What if he just doesn't know the right route? And he's going to go what he thinks is the shortcut or the right route, and they got to go 2 hours out of their way because he took... But it doesn't matter. What's the dividing thing? Sin. Sin is the line that the woman cannot cross. Any decision that causes her or her children to be involved with sin, that's where you say, you put the brakes on. You say, whoa. It ain't right. I love you, but I see where this is headed. And anybody that has a wife that won't do that doesn't deserve the wife that God's given them. See, part of it is it's really hard for a woman to do this. I thought, if I was married, could I really trust that guy to make these decisions? Oh, man. I'd be on my knees a whole lot more than I already am, trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do, which path we're supposed to take. And guess what? I've taken detours that take a lot longer than 2 hours to make up for. And when I make decisions that she doesn't agree with, she doesn't say, I'm overruling you. But if she comes to me and she says, are you sure this is what you want to do? Are you sure? And then if that doesn't work, and I say, yes. She says, are you sure that God, this is what God wants you to do? Whoa. You better think long and hard about that one. But if we continue on, it says, husbands, Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. That means no matter what it takes, no matter what you have to do, no matter what you have to endure, or how much you have to suffer, you will literally give your life for that woman that God has given you. As long as she is doing what God says to do. How many times do women compromise and go along with their husbands when the husband is leading them into sin? And how many times do men compromise and go along with their wives when the wife is leading them into sin? Now, we know that with Adam and Eve, the serpent deceived Eve first. But whose fault was it, really? Adam. It says, and she gave to her husband who was with her. What's he doing? It's on her, God. It's that woman you gave me. How'd that work?
Didn't work.
How do you think it works with men that blame their wives for everything? Maybe the problem is them. I know for almost every single thing that we've done wrong in my household, it's my fault. Because I either did it, led as the example, or allowed it to happen. It's on my head. And I'm the one that's going to answer to God for that. And if more men can understand that and actually do that, do you know how many Abrahams there can be? Verse 26, that he may sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. If God's word, if his way of life, if his instructions are not an integral part of your life, how can you possibly fulfill and do this thing that we are all as men commanded to do? 27, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. And for this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. There's no way a wife can respect a husband that doesn't love and respect her and isn't a godly man. If you had somebody in a position of authority over you that was a dictator and a tyrant and a huge sinner, could you respect that man? What makes you think your wife can do it with you? Can God look down from his throne and say this about you if you're a man? Genesis 12, verse 2, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. It takes a special man for God to be able to say that. Now people can say, there's only one Abraham. That's true. How would you like to be 1/100th of one Abraham? What a blessing that would be. Can he say this about us? Genesis 18, verse 19. For I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. If Abraham wouldn't have been faithful, if Abraham wouldn't have had the heart that he had, if Abraham wouldn't have loved God above all else, including his only son, God could not have used them. We wouldn't be reading about him. Would it be somebody else? If you love your wife and you love your children, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, your children, your grandchildren, and if you live long enough, your great-grandchildren, and if you live really long and God has blessed you a lot, your great-great-grandchildren. What a legacy. Every man in this room is supposed to be an Abraham. If our lives are not going where we want and we feel we're doing our part, what are we supposed to do? Where do we go? Jesus is our head. We have a boss. And everything we say and do and think, we're answerable to Him. He's responsible for our needs. Just like the husband is responsible for the family's needs. You might as well put a sign on your back that says, "The buck stops here." Because it does. If there's a problem in the family, the men are responsible. If the kids don't respect him, he didn't respect them. He set the example. If your wife doesn't respect you, you didn't respect her. See, I think women get the short end of the stick. Because God put it in their hearts and in their whole beings that they're looking for this knight in shining armor that's going to come and carry them away to paradise and provide for every need that they have and be this wonderful husband and wonderful father. And then they wake up one day and look at the guy that they married. If the kids are a mess and undisciplined, it's the dad's house. That's a problem, I mean. If the house isn't clean, instead of blaming the woman, did you create the environment that even if she tries, she can't keep it clean? Do you help? We're all responsible. If there's no money, either we haven't provided, or we have gotten ourselves into a situation where it's impossible for us to provide off of what we have. Interesting, some people say, "Well, I'm broke, I'm poor, I don't have no money, and I've suffered from that syndrome all my life," with a few exceptions, short-lived. But then when you look around, not only does dad have one of these expensive little toys, mom has one, and the kids all have them too. And then the bigger the toy, because they come in many sizes, the more the cost is for that. I don't have any money. But yet I've got a $200 a month cable bill and a $250 a month cell phone bill, and my toys that I have bought that are required for work. There's a $400 a month payment on that one. So I need it. Those 40-inch tires and that diesel exhaust, and, you know, I needed it. I couldn't get by with a little 15-year-old Ford Ranger or Chevy S10. I had to have a brand-new four-door jacked-up pickup truck to get to work. Or this, I couldn't get by with a, I don't know, what's kind of like the least car out there right now. I used to say Yugo, but most people don't even know what a Yugo is anymore.
1998 Dodge Caravan.
Okay. 1998 Dodge Caravan with the transmission, on the third transmission, because that's probably pretty accurate for those. Had to have that. No! No! Can't have that. We've got to have a big SUV. Well, we were smart about it, you know. It was a trade-in. It was a lease car. It was only 2 years old when we bought it. So instead of the payment being $500 a month, it's only $325. Now, it's not fun doing those kinds of things. I used to have to drive cars. Probably the worst one I ever had. A close friend of mine gave it to me. It was January in Wisconsin. We went to his house to pick up the car. It was a Ford Pinto. Okay? Now I said, "Where is it, Don?" And he says, "Right there, you're in the front of the house." He says, "You can see the antenna sticking out of the snow." And sure enough, there was about 10 or 12 inches of radio antenna sticking above the snow. And he gave me a shovel and he says, "It's yours. All you got to do is dig it out. You can have it." So I grabbed that shovel and I started digging, and the battery was dead. Luckily, it wasn't froze solid. So he pulled his car around and we jumped it and got it started. And when we go somewhere on that, you know how sometimes she wasn't a teenager even at that time, she was a young girl, but she had friends and went to school and everything. My oldest daughter would lay down in the back seat so that none of her friends could see her in that car. I got pulled over one time for something in that car, stopped by the cops for something. And the cop comes up, and I got my wallet out, and I'm going to give him my driver's license. And I see him look down at the car. He got a strange look on his face, and he reached over. He put his hand on the gun, and I looked where he was looking, and then I realized. See, there was no ignition in that car. The steering column, the plastic column was gone around it. There's a little rod that goes from where the ignition was down, and you move that rod, pull and push it, to shut the car off and to start it, engage, and it was a little spring-loaded deal. And once it started, you let it go, and it'd come in, and then the car would run. So I looked at him and said, "Officer, wait a minute. If I was going to steal a car, do you think I would honestly steal this car?" He thought about it, and he says, "Well, can I see your license, please?" Had to be careful with that car. It was a Wisconsin car. And the floors were all rotted out. I took some of Mary's cookie sheets and put them down on the floor, and then the back of the driver's seat. It was bolt. There was floor where the front of the seat bolts down. But the back of it, there was a hole about 2 feet plus in diameter. And then there was holes on the other side. It was really interesting in the cold spring morning. When it had rained the night before, which happened one time, that there was holes in the passenger side in the front. See, I stuck the cookies. Mary gave me the cookie sheet, and I stuck it behind the driver's seat so that it wouldn't hit the ground. But she had a long dress, and we were headed to church, and I went over a puddle, and that water went right up her dress. And it was about 40 degrees outside, and that water was close to it, and all I heard was, "Woo!" And then if you went over like a railroad track, the car would flex like this, and it would knock it out of gear. So after you got over the railroad track, you had to put the clutch back in and put it back in gear so you could keep on going. I know what it's like to drive a junker car. But I had other priorities. And I didn't have any choice but to drive cars like that too at the same time. But what's... Huh? Yeah, I had a AMC Pacer. We called it... Well, I won't tell you what we called it. Yep. Sold it right before we moved to Tennessee. Somebody was actually stupid enough to buy that car. But anyhow, what are some of the roles of a husband? Number one, he is the priest of the family. What does the priest do?
Intercedes.
Serves. Serves. And teaches. Those are the two primary roles. And if they're not serving and teaching, they can't make intercession. Deuteronomy 6:6 says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as spotless between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." Now, some people think that just going down and buying a mezuzah and nailing it on your front door and buying some phylacteries is all it takes to fulfill this. Wrong. First, you have to teach them diligently to your children. When you're sitting around in the house, when you're walking by the way, when you're out and about with your children, when you lie down, when you're tired, when you rise up and you wake up in the morning and you're busy and you got to get things going and you got to get to work, you got to do this, you got to do that. Have you talked to your children about this? You shall bind them as a sign on your hand everything you do. Shall be as spotless between your eyes. Everything you think. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Every time you come and go, you have to realize what it is you're supposed to be doing as the patriarch and the priest of that family. Number two, a provider. 1 Timothy 5:8, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." That doesn't mean that the woman doesn't do anything. Well, you get off your lazy butt and get a second job. You only work 8 hours a day. You only sleep 8 more. That's room for a whole nother career for you. But what about somebody that won't work? What about somebody that won't provide? A couple months ago, I had a conversation with somebody in my family. He was in his early 20s. And I told him, I says, "If I can work between 60 and 70 plus hours a week and you're one third my age, you better get off your butt and start making a living. You better start providing." But he didn't even have a job. Number three. And these aren't necessarily, I just started thinking, what is the duties? And I'm sure I missed some, and these aren't in the order of importance necessarily. Protector. Somebody that lets someone else attack their wife and their children. And stands by. Let her have it. She's got it coming. I've told her I don't know how many times. Is not a protector. An example. Now, somebody that stands up for their wife and their children because it affects their ego. And then if there was some validity in what was going on, doesn't make a effort to correct those things that were wrong, they're worse than the person that attacked them in the first place. They're enabling. It's like somebody coming up to the sidewalk and begging for money, and you can smell the booze coming off their breath, and you hand them $5. And the liquor store is right next door. And we're supposed to help people, but... Oh, you got some change to spare? I'm hungry. Go take them and get them some food. Don't give them money to go buy the booze if that's their problem. Or drugs if that's their problem. Or whatever their problem is, don't enable them so that they can continue in the problem. Too often a husband is an enabler, not a protector. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. He would do anything. He did anything, including giving his life for us. But he didn't heal somebody and say, there you go, you're all fixed up, go and sin some more. 1 Peter 3:7 says, husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. If you don't give your wife the honor and the respect and the love that you're commanded to do, God's not going to listen to your prayers. So if you're out there praying, God, you got to straighten this woman out you gave me. You don't even hear it. Number four, a parent. Yes, one of two, but a parent. The spiritual head of that household. Remember, you got the sign on your back that says, the buck stops here. Ephesians 6:4. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. This one time I took my oldest daughter and I said, you realize, sweetie, or whatever I called her, that the closest thing we have to a Levitical priest today are ministers in God's real church. And then I read her the verse where it talks about if the priest's daughter becomes the harlot, they're supposed to take her and burn her. So I taught that little girl too much because she quoted this one back on me. Ephesians 6:4, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. That was the right answer. Number five, a lover. When Isaac, Genesis 24:67, when Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Never forget, your wife is your lover. How do we go and we pursue women when we're young and we do all these things? Heck, I remember Mary and I were on a date and I had to fart and I got out of the car. I closed the door. And she looked like, what are you doing? Now, throw the blankets up over her head. Why do we have one standard when we want them and another standard after we got them? That's why I tell women, I've mentioned this before, he'll change. Because they all think, well, yeah, he's got some flaws, but we'll get married and he'll love me so much and he'll change. You get to change him when he gets really old. You get to change his depends. That's the first time he's going to change. Except too often he changes for the worse. He does change. Because he's not acting like a priest. He's not there to serve and provide and nurture and love and protect his wife and his family. At one point we had a lot of problems in the church and you know whose fault it was? Mine. But one of the things that was wrong was there wasn't respect for the things that were dedicated to God. But if we don't respect the things that are dedicated to God, our wives and our children, we're failing there. And yes, everything that's dedicated to God, everything that's holy, everything should be treated as special and set aside. But if you only do it to something physical and not the greatest gift that God has ever given you, the number one task that He's assigned to every man, his wife and his children, it's more important than anything else. Than a job, than a reputation, than a possession. I should have maybe done all the blessings about wives and family and a quiver that's full, and there's all kinds of information that's in the Bible. Genesis 26, verse 8 says, "Now it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac, showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife." When's the last time you showed endearment, love? Women need that. Nobody in this room knows one of the sweetest widows that taught me an awful lot. That when we came to Tennessee, was the host for the church, so that the minister who lived in Benton, Tennessee, an hour plus away, she'd come, she'd unlock it, she'd get things ready, and he'd drive up here and give the sermons and stuff. One day she's at our, and I talked about this before recently, but one day she's at our house having supper with us. Never met her husband, but knew a lot about him from even other people that knew him. And but he had died 2-3 years before we met Ina Mae. And this was a couple years after we knew her, so her husband had been dead 5 years plus, probably. And one night at supper, she's crying. We get all concerned. "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And she told me, she says, "Can you just give me a hug? It's been so long since anybody has held me and hugged me." Mary and I both ended up crying that night. That is something our wives and our children, but especially our wives, need. To know that this man, this stranger, different from somebody that she married, loves her, respects her, and will die for her. Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 16 says, "His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." Mary's got a ring I bought her. See, we were Seventh-day Adventists, so they didn't have wedding rings when we were in the church. So years later, I bought her a ring. And it's a very high standard for me to live up to. Now, most women think it's about them. But one of the first things she did is she memorized it in Hebrew. It comes from Song of Solomon. Want to take a try at it? Still remember? There's the mic there. Turn it on. All right, say it loud. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. Tried finding something that would represent what I truly felt about her. And yes, the statement is, she is mine, but it also says, I'm hers. And I have to be the kind of man and a husband that God says I'm supposed to be, and I fail every day at it, but the standard doesn't change. First Samuel 1:18 says, Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? We're responsible for our wives' emotional well-being along with the physical. The buck stops here. If a husband's going to be a leader, he has to lead. He's got to put on his big boy pants. He can't wear women's undies. Or act like he's wearing women's undies. A ship needs a captain, an army needs a general, and a wife needs a husband, and a family needs a father. And when you take any one of those things away, you have dysfunction and chaos. And Satan can have his way. So men, it's up to you to say Joshua 24:15, and if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, who's making that decision? As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Because if you don't make that decision, your wife should then. After we leave today, are we all going to go back to the world? Are we longing for leavening the sin of the world? Did we learn anything this year? Are we going to let the leaven of the world back into our lives to corrupt and rot us and kill us? Or do we really believe Philippians 4:13, where it says that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us? Because we can't do it ourselves. But with God, nothing's impossible. And even just like the fiery furnace, even if we suffer a consequence for doing what's right, then you suffer the consequence. Because if you're not willing to do that, no matter what the consequence is, you're not worthy to be the priest of your own home. You're not worthy to be the patriarch of your family. And you're not worthy to be the husband of your wife and the father of your children, because you're not doing what God has tasked you to do. Get off the fence and be a godly man. That's your job. Serve your family by leading them and teaching them God's ways so that He can look down from His throne and call you His faithful servant. Because you're either a friend of God or a friend of Satan. And there's no in between.